White Rocket Entertainment.
White Rocket Entertainment, podcast number 275.
You are listening to the AU Wishbone, almost credible sports discussion on the War Eagle Sports Radio Network.
Hello and welcome to the AU Wishbone, brought to you by White Rocket Entertainment in association with the WarEagleReader.com and the War Eagle Sports Radio Network. I'm Van Allen Plexico, and I'm joined as always by my co-host.
I'm John Ringer.
And John, after much battling with the Satan that is Skype, we got him. We have our special guest tonight, Jerry Hennen. Welcome to the Wishbone for your first ever visit, Jerry.
It's been way too long for this to finally occur. It is very, very good to be on the show, guys.
We're so glad to have you. We've followed your work in various locations for quite a long time now. And is that not so, John?
At Joe Cribb's Car Wash.
Yes.
It's stunning how long ago that was. The Joe Cribb's Car Wash started in January 2006. So that's 11 and a half actual years. And in internet slash media years, that's actually 48 years that you guys have been reading my work now. So
that's a geologic age in the internet.
It really is.
Yeah, wow, that's amazing. We always enjoyed that. And then you did some stuff for the War Eagle Reader for a while. In fact, you know, as much as anybody, you and Jeremy are the reason that John and I even have this show, because the very first thing that he and I ever, well, we had been doing stuff in smaller venues for a long time, but, you know, our first real, you know, broader exposure to the Auburn family was getting a column with Jeremy with War Eagle Reader when you were still there.
And I had a great time working with Jeremy. I mean, I'm still working with Jeremy. The stuff I write now, obviously, that's scaled back a little bit, jobs, kids, etc. But I've been trying to write a little bit more for the War Eagle Reader this year. I've had a few things pop up here and there. And so, yeah, Jeremy and I, you know, we've also been working together for a long time. And you know, there's a reason that that's still the outlet that when I've got something to write about Auburn sports, that's where I write it. Mm-hmm. Is because, you know, guys like Jeremy, you know, he runs the site, you guys are there, lots of other great writers have passed through there, so always happy to have that association. And again, you know, that's part of the reason I'm happy to be talking to you guys tonight. And you know, as we've said, it's been a year's worth of you know, putting in the sweat over there and in various places. And, you know, it's really nice to be able to kind of come back. You know, I think most of the people listening to this probably know I wrote for CBS Sports for about 5 years. Mm-hmm. But being able to come back to my Auburn roots from time to time is pretty awesome. So, again, great to be on the show and ready to talk some Auburn football.
Well, let's do it. We want to move on ahead and dig into it. We've got quite a few questions of our own, and we'll see in a little bit if we got any I just realized I don't have the soundboard up, and John will be bitterly disappointed.
Oh, gosh darn. All right. While you play with that, I can ask a question.
Go, go, go.
All right, Jerry, we've heard a lot about the transfer situation, and Antoine Jackson's been whining about not being able to go to South Carolina or Ohio State. So what should the rule for undergraduate transfers be in college football? I mean, I look at the landscape. Quarterbacks are transferring at an incredibly high rate compared to, you know, 10 years ago, and other positions are transferring more. What should the rule be for undergraduates and why?
Yeah, for undergraduates, I don't have a problem with coaches putting a restriction on teams that are on your schedule, that are going, you know, within your conference. I think if it's a team that's not going to be on your schedule for a while, in the case of South Carolina, I forget when we play them again, but, you know, anybody in the East that's not Georgia, it occurs so infrequently. I'd prefer us not to have a restriction for most of those East teams other than Georgia. But, you know, if Malzahn says, well, you know, we're recruiting against those guys, which we do against South Carolina from time to time, I don't want to help them succeed, you know, okay, I can stomach that. You know, in a case of an Ohio State, you know, anywhere else outside the conference, it's not something I'm a fan of. I feel like for me, It's a little bit hypocritical in that we're looking at, you know, the reason that we're not paying these players, despite the bajillions of dollars that they're helping bring into the athletic department, is because they're there to get an education. This is what we say. Well, we're getting a scholarship. You're getting your education. So when a football player turns around and says, okay, that's great, but I would like to continue my education somewhere else, to then say, ah, sorry, you're a football player. You know, that strikes me as kind of getting them both coming and going. So I don't have a problem with South Carolina as much. Although, you know, you go back, Will Muschamp several years ago let us take Mike Blakely as a transfer without putting any restrictions on him. I would have preferred, you know, for Gus to follow that route. That I don't have a problem with. And, you know, I think there probably are some kind of reasons there with Ohio State. I don't think he, like, pulled them out of the air to just say, oh, well, you can't go to Ohio State. But, you know, Antoine Jackson, I think, you know, I don't see how it helps Auburn's program not to just be done with this entire saga as fast as possible. If he wants to go to Ohio State, let's let bygones let be bygones, and he can go. As far as a rule goes, you know, I think, you know, the rules that are in place, I'm kind of okay with, as far as like the NCAA and transfers and sitting out a year, this kind of stuff. I'm fine with graduates being able to go pretty much wherever they want. If you want to put in the schoolwork and do that, more power to you. I think we need to encourage more kids to graduate. But in terms of the sort of unwritten laws about where you can restrict your transfers and not, I generally side with the players.
Do we know why he's transferring? Has there been anything come out about that?
What I've heard is, you know, they weren't delighted with his effort in the off season and in the second half of last year in terms of, you know, practice and workouts and that kind of stuff. And I think he just decided he looked at the depth chart and the other guys coming in and on the team and what they were asking him to do, and he wants to go somewhere else. That, in terms of the South Carolina thing, I think part of that is related to Muschamp and Tavares Robinson being there. And I think the deal was with kind of when they left Auburn that, you know, Gus made it, you know, and them kind of talked about not trying to poach each other's players. And the biggest thing with transfers is I don't, as far as I'm concerned, they can transfer wherever as long as they got to sit out a year. But what you don't want is tampering, like where other coaches are talking to guys before they leave a program to try to recruit them basically while they're still on your team. Like, that's what we don't want to get into that kind of craziness. But other than that, I'm with Jerry.
Well, I just want to say real quick, I my thinking on this has kind of evolved over the last year or so, because I originally listened to people that were saying I'm totally always with the player, you know, and I was getting that. But the more I started thinking about it, I thought, well, you know, these are guys that quite a few of them, you know, Auburn is paying everything for them to be there, under the understanding they'd come and help us out sports-wise in exchange for getting all the stuff that costs a bajillion dollars now to go to college. And as somebody sending an 18-year-old off to college this fall, I understand exactly how much they're getting, you know. And so I can see where the university would have a vested interest in what they've put into somebody and not want them to go and take that investment and go off and use it against, you know, either directly or indirectly against that school. So if all those people were doing were just going to class, then no, you couldn't tell the student you can't go to some other school. But when you have such a vested interest, such an investment in them, I can kind of understand why schools feel justified in having some restrictions. Does that make any sense at all?
It does. I would counter that by saying that the money that Auburn has put into, you know, Antoine Jackson's football education probably wasn't going to pay off regardless. You know, frankly, as John said, it did not look like Jackson was going to make a sizable dent in this year's playing rotation. I, you know, may have seen time, but it didn't really seem to be working out from a football perspective here in Auburn. And frankly, if you're, you know, looking at it from Auburn's perspective, it might be better off. You know, we have a limited number of these scholarships, of these opportunities that we can offer. You can't go past 85. Right. If Jackson's not there, they can turn around and offer that right away to either another transfer, to an incoming freshman. You know, it's that's fewer resources that they're necessarily spending here, strictly from a football perspective, on a player who especially if he does not want to be there, if he is simply sort of playing out the string and, as John sort of mentions, not necessarily getting along with the coaching staff. And I'll say I'm not up on what was happening behind the scenes with Jackson, but I think, let's put it this way, if he was on the best terms with the coaches, I don't think we would have seen these kinds of restrictions. I think, you know, if this was purely, you know, he's got good reasons for doing this, if this was purely about education, if it was about, you know, hypothetically going home to, like, his parents or something, I don't think you would see these kinds of restrictions. I tend to side with the idea that things weren't all hunky-dory between Jackson and the coaches. At that point, this is where, again, I ask, like, how does this help Auburn, like, to keep him away from Ohio State? Again, if you're keeping him away from other SEC teams, okay, those are teams where programs were in direct competition with, you know, Ohio State, then we're starting to, you know, I don't understand. That's where it starts to sort of leak over into petty. And I'm not necessarily, you know, accusing Gus Malzahn of pettiness, but, you know, we're sort of in that direction once we start talking about Ohio State or other non-conference schools. I think he was banned from going to Mercer as well. They're on the schedule, but it's kind of like, you know, Auburn's not going to lose to Mercer because Antoine Jackson goes there.
Going to turn the tide.
Let's not use that expression.
Yeah, really. So at that point, I'm kind of like, you know, I think it's in Auburn's best interest just to get him out the door, get this behind the program. But, you know, also, it's June. We probably wouldn't even necessarily be discussing this in these terms if it was September. So, you know, I think it's been a little bit blown out of proportion. But all of that said, I do think it's high time for, you know, Gus to just say, whatever, let's wash our hands. See ya. Let's move on.
Well, let's move to something much more interesting, I think, which is, John, you had a couple of questions. I think we should roll into one for Jerry. You're asking about Chip Lindsey and the offense, and particularly what aspect of it, John?
I want to say, how do you feel the offense is going to do? What do you think, watching, you know, kind of the at times painful Auburn offense the last 2 years and at times great, what's going to be the single biggest difference?
Well, it's going to be tricky this fall watching Auburn's offense and trying to figure out where the differences are coming, either from Chip Lindsey or are they coming from Jarrett Stidham?
Yeah.
Because having a quarterback like Jarrett Stidham is going to warp your offense around him, like whatever Gus would have done, even whatever Rhett Lashley would have done if he was still here. You know, things would have been dramatically different just from having Jarrett Stidham under center. Now we've got Stidham, and we've got a new offensive coordinator. So things, you know, I realize this is very much the same sort of rough framework of an offense that we've been used to over the past several years. But, you know, those are two major changes. And we're not just talking about, like, oh, it's a different quarterback. Like, Stidham's strengths are so different from what we've seen from Auburn's quarterbacks, basically whenever Gus Malzahn has been the offensive coordinator, that I think we're going to see something, you know, fairly different. And Lindsey, I do think, watching Arizona State the last couple of years, very heavy on the screens, you know, not quite as much with the downfield passing as I think Gus would be when he has the quarterback who can pull that off, as we saw with Cam. When we saw sort of at the end of Nick Marshall's tenure, when Marshall really kind of got the hang of getting the ball downfield, I think Gus likes to go deep, maybe a little bit more than Lindsey would. I think Lindsey is more sort of like, let's spread them out, let's throw screens and bubbles and kind of get the defense moving side to side, get our dudes in space. I forget, you know, the name of the Arizona State running back now. I'm blanking on him, who had all those receptions last year. But that's kind of what I think about when I think of a Chip Lindsey offense, is let's spread them out and let's throw the ball to our running backs, through our little sort of shifty wide receivers, and get yards that way. And I don't think that's the best use of Stidham. I think the best use of Stidham, as we saw in the spring game, is, all right, like, let's do the Baylor thing and have our wide receivers all run as fast down the field as they possibly can, and then have Stidham load up the artillery cannon. So I think there's going to be a little bit of kind of a push and pull there. You know, I think we're going to see something of kind of a mix of all of that. And then you've got, I mean, obviously you got to feed Cameron Petway as well. So, you know, I'm not sure how well I'm answering your question here, John, but I think, you know, there's going to be some tension there. I think we're going to have to figure that tension out pretty quickly with Clemson in week 2. I would expect to see more deep passing than we've seen from Lindsey, more running straight ahead than we necessarily would have seen from Lindsey, but definitely between both Lindsey and Stidham, a lot more passing than we would have seen the last couple of years under Gus.
So do you see a possible point of contention and stress between Gus saying, throw it deep, and Lindsey just kind of wanting dink and dunk? Because, Jerry, I was going to mention this. John and I have talked about this several times before. You may have heard this. Yeah. We've made note that Auburn has barely used any kind of screen passing game ever under Gus. That's just something he's never really gone in for.
Yeah, no, our running backs have not caught the ball a whole lot. Occasionally they've done a little bit of that. Like, we've seen some wheel route action from time to time. I think it was Cam Martin who had the big reception, I want to say, against Arkansas last year. But it hasn't necessarily been a feature of the offense, and certainly not the way it was, again, with Chip Lindsey. It's killing me that I can't remember the name of the running back, but I think he finished with 1,000 yards, both receiving and rushing, maybe last year, maybe the year before. I, again, not pulling it out off the top of my head. But that's definitely been a feature of Lindsey's offense. I don't know if I would call it a stress point. I think, it's a case of, the nice thing here is that Stidham can do whatever you ask him to do. If you want him to bomb it away two downs out of every four, he can do that. If you want him to dart little screen passes underneath, he can do that too. It's, again, going back to Lindsey's tenure out in Tempe, he did not have a Jarrett Stidham. There are not a lot of Jarrett Stidhams running around out there. His quarterbacks there were very much kind of in the sort of spread, in some ways, Sean White mold, where they don't necessarily have the arm strength where you want to say, okay, well, let's line it up and, run four verts and just go like that. So it's a little bit of, again, I think Stidham more maybe even so than Lindsey is going to shape what we're going to see out of the Auburn offense this season. I think if you've got a weapon like that, whether you're Chip Lindsey, whether you're Rhett Lashley, whether you're Gus Malzahn, whoever, you are going to see plenty of shots down the field. And I think Lindsey is a smart enough guy, given what he accomplished with the personnel there at Arizona State, that he's going to be able to use Stidham the way that Jarrett Stidham ought to be used. And I do think, you never want to read too much into the spring game, but that's pretty much what we saw, I thought, there at A-Day.
One more thing, John, I'll follow up, and I'm going to throw it completely over you for a minute. Jerry, did you see Jarrett Stidham interview with Luganville the other day? And Luganville asked him something like, what's the difference between the Baylor offense and what you're doing now? And Stidham said, well, the Baylor offense speaks for itself. It's explosive. You could score every play. He was a little more qualifying. I don't remember the exact words he used, but he was drawing a definite distinction, just like you were a minute ago, between the two. Yeah. And I'm kind of chewing my fingernails going, oh, man, I hope Stidham's not, like, disappointed. And, I'm like, oh, man. So should I have been nervous there, or what do you make of that?
No, he's not going to come in, and I think, maybe he might nudge Lindsey and Gus a little bit more in the direction of, hey, let's go for the jugular here and there the way Baylor did. Yeah. But I don't think there's really going to be any unhappiness. I think it comes down to winning, honestly. If you win ball games, everybody's happy. As long as Auburn goes out there and the offense is productive, and the Tigers are winning football games, I don't think Stidham's ever going to really have any serious complaints. I think, coming from Baylor, I think, there's probably something of, this is what I'm used to, and I don't think anybody's going to say, oh, well, clearly the Baylor system worked exceptionally well for Baylor. But at the same time, Gus is the one with experience in the SEC. Frankly, the Pac-12, despite its reputation as a much, much stronger defensive league these days than the Big 12 is. Jarrett Stidham's not playing at Baylor these days. I think he understands that. He's a quarterback. He wants to do what quarterbacks do, and especially quarterbacks with his kind of arm do, and especially quarterbacks who come from Baylor do, which is to throw the ball 50 yards down the field to a wide-open KD Cannon. That's not necessarily going to happen
anywhere else. Anywhere. I mean, where could he have gone that he could have gotten that? Right. So yeah.
No, exactly. Baylor is pretty much sui generis at this point. Like, nobody puts the pedal to the metal quite the way Baylor has done for the last several years. You can't even do that at Baylor now. You know, maybe Dino Babers at Syracuse might be the closest thing. He was another Art Briles disciple there. Philip Montgomery at Tulsa, you know, but again, these are not SEC programs. Those are not programs that are going to face SEC defenses week in and week out. Stidham is going to do what he's asked to do. I think Lindsey is going to take advantage of what Stidham brings to the table. And again, as long as the offense works, and I think it will, I think that's all going to be a not even water under the bridge. I think more of a trickle under the bridge.
Jerry, the name of the player at Arizona State you were trying to remember was Kalen Ballage, who had...
Was it Ballage? I thought Ballage was the power back. I thought there was a little shifty dude.
Well, he
but maybe
had,
you're right.
He's the leading receiver listed at running back. I mean, there was a guy named Enkeel Harry. I don't know if that's the guy. But Ballage had 40, for comparison purposes, Ballage had 44 receptions last year. I would like for you two to guess which Auburn running back has led Auburn in receptions and how many they had under Gus's tenure. So say since 2013.
Oh, okay. Since 2013, which Auburn running back has led Auburn in receptions?
No, has had the most receptions in one season, and how many receptions were there? This guy at Arizona State caught 44 last year.
Man. It might be a fullback. What do you think,
I'm going to say it's Kerryon Johnson.
I'm going to say... I wanted to say Mario Fannin, but that was back before, so... Corey Grant?
The answer is Kerryon Johnson last year with 17 receptions.
17. Yeah, there we go. DJ Foster, by the way, I pulled out my 2016 Phil Steele. He has graduated, but in 2015, he had 59 receptions for 584 yards.
Okay.
I want to say, like, the year before that, he may have done even better. So I think DJ Foster was the guy I was talking about. But again, like this Ballage guy, as you point out, just came in and, you know, had a very similar sort of season with 44 receptions, even though my recollection is that he was more the power back kind of guy. So, yeah, that like I said, is a feature of what Chip Lindsey has wanted to do in Tempe. I think if you're Cam Martin in particular, I think you're probably pretty excited about that. That would be the first name that would come to mind when I try to think of, like, okay, who will Auburn really make an effort to get the ball to out of the backfield?
He is kind of more the Mario Fannin type, isn't he, compared to like a Petway or even a – well, I mean,
Kerryon catching the ball out of the backfield is going to be like the X factor in a lot of games. I just think he's really good at that.
There you go. You had to have it.
And I think we're going to take more advantage of it. All right, I got another question. Jerry, what worries you the most about this Auburn team in 2017? So what is the limiting factor for Auburn success?
For me, it's the pass rush. You know, I look at Auburn's roster, and certainly Marlon Davidson has a lot of potential. I'm really excited to see if Byron Cowart can get some push on passing downs from the interior. I think that could make a big difference for Auburn if he's kind of the light has come on there the way some people have said, you know, it looks like it maybe has this offseason. But, you know, Auburn didn't do a fantastic job of rushing the passer last year when they had Carl Lawson. And, you know, I look at our defensive ends and I think, you know, I wonder if they're more sort of the rugged run defending types in some ways, maybe more than necessarily a pass rush. And, you know, our secondary is solid. I think Carlton Davis and Javaris Davis have been underrated, you know, looking through all these preseason All-American, preseason All-SEC lists, you know, the preseason magazine sort of write-ups and this sort of thing. I think those guys have the potential to be, you know, if not the best pair of cover corners in the SEC, then at least, you know, top three, top five, something like that. So I'm not necessarily, like, cowering about the prospect of third and long for opposing teams, but, you know, I'm not sure if I would look at Auburn and say I'm really confident that they're going to be able to rush the passer, certainly the way they have the last couple of years. And, you know, last year in particular, it wasn't even necessarily that Carl Lawson was sacking the quarterback every other time he dropped back, but that his presence allowed Montrevious Adams and some of the other guys to, you know, do their thing. And without that gravity on the outside, I would worry a little bit about whether Auburn is going to be able to get to the passer as frequently as we would like them to.
You know, speaking of Byron Cowart, I think about Byron Cowart, and I think about all those people that said he was the greatest recruit ever to come into Auburn, and all I can think is,
you lied to me.
And I think if they really thought that...
It's not over yet, Matt. I think Auburn has not had the greatest luck with, like, the five-star, you know, top-of-the-line recruits necessarily over the years, but... Montrevious Adams was in a sort of similar boat. He was a five-star defensive tackle, and you know, it took him a couple of years to get going. I'm really hopeful. I have my fingers crossed so hard that, you know, they've moved him into the interior. You know, he's going to play kind of both, you know, at tackle and on the end, especially on passing downs. I've got my fingers crossed that we see something special out of him this year. We have to hope. We have to hope, Greg.
Yeah.
All right, Van, you want to go next? You want me to go next?
Well, yeah, shifting gears just a little bit. The other main thing, I mean, before we're done tonight, I want to talk to you a little bit about the U.S. national team. We got to get into that since we got you on the show. We share a love for that whole thing. John will take a nap during that.
I was going to say, John, you're up for that, right?
Absolutely.
You know what? when we move the topic in that area, John will just...
smoke weed every day.
But anyway, that just never fails to make me happy. But I wanted to talk about this, right? We talked a lot about SEC alignment and realignment and moving Auburn to the East and all that. I don't want to go too far into that. I just want to get your opinion on this. People, you know, I've seen some talk this week about, you know, how is Missouri fitting in? How is Texas A&M fitting in? In fact, it was Barrett Salee this week that kind of not on purpose, he didn't know I was going to talk about this, but he anticipated what I wanted to talk to you about, because he was asking how are Missouri and Texas A&M fitting in. And I was going to ask you, not only how are Missouri and Texas A&M fitting in your opinion, I got to tell you, I'm still not even sold on Arkansas and South Carolina. Okay? I'm still not sure.
I'm with you.
Yeah. So that's part one, is how are these noobs fitting in? And part two is Auburn LSU rivalry. Is it really a thing? And am I just a dinosaur? Okay, go.
you're not. I Auburn and LSU is really interesting because it's had so much riding on it for so long. Like, you know, especially before Nick Saban arrived. That was the defining game in the SEC West more years than not. It just had so much riding on it. In Tuberville, when he was there, those games were so frequently very close, very tight, very exciting. You know, I think that was sort of where the talk of it being a rivalry and this Tiger Bowl sort of thing came from, is that, you know, we just kind of got smashed together and things worked out that way. Mm-hmm. Do I feel like it's organic the way that I do when I think about playing Georgia or even Florida or Tennessee or, you know, mm-hmm. even Georgia Tech still, you know, the rivals that, you know, I remember growing up with? Mm-hmm. No. Now, some of that has to do with how old I am. I suspect, you know, okay, I'm 38. You ask an Auburn fan who's 26,
right,
would you rather play LSU every year or Florida every year? And, you know, they're going to laugh at you. They're going to say, of course we're going to play LSU every year. So, you know, I don't want to be the old fuddy-duddy that says, well, it has to be this way because this is the way it was when I was growing up. But it was also the way it was when, like, my dad was growing up. And it was also the way it was when my grandfather was growing up. And so I think there is that kind of institutional memory. And so to me, that's what it boils down to with adding Arkansas and adding South Carolina and adding Texas A&M and adding Missouri. I feel like Arkansas and South Carolina and Texas A&M, culture-wise, I think they fit in just fine. These are all football-mad mm-hmm. institutions. South Carolina, you know, I wasn't necessarily sold until they sold out Williams-Brice like that year before Lou Holtz got there when they lost all their games. They went 0-11 mm-hmm. and still sold out every game for the following season. You know, that's SEC commitment right yeah. there, right? We can acknowledge that. Arkansas, you know, remember the whole FOIA mess with Houston Nutt. Yeah, they're crazy enough. They're in the club. Come on, guys. And even Texas A&M, you know, those are some weird, weird dudes in some ways down there. But again, like Kyle Field, I think, is an SEC atmosphere. LSU and Texas A&M, you know, talking about old rivalries. I have some cousins from Louisiana, and I remember getting together when we were like 8 years old, and all of their, you know, dumb Bama fan jokes, all of their jokes were dumb Aggie jokes, because LSU and Texas A&M couldn't stand each other back then. So, you know, there's a rivalry there that stretches back a little bit. So, you know, in terms of the culture, I think those three programs are fine. Missouri, you know, I'm sorry. It's not working for me. It feels weird every single time I see Missouri playing an SEC team and having it be an SEC school. It just, it's just not exactly the same. Maybe that's for me. Maybe Missouri fans don't feel like that. Maybe Arkansas fans, maybe Texas A&M fans that are a little bit more sort of familiar with Missouri, it doesn't feel that way to them. You know, it just does not feel like it's working for me. The way the other three programs are. Now, that said, like, there is never going to be a point for me where I would rather play Arkansas, South Carolina, or Texas A&M instead of Florida, Tennessee, or even like a Georgia Tech or somebody like that. Like, those games do not matter as much to me as playing those other programs do, and they never will. Like, it is never going to feel more natural to me to play South Carolina than to play Florida. It's never going to feel more natural to me to play Arkansas or Texas A&M instead of playing Florida. And so that's what galls me about the expansion, is that it makes the regular season matter less. Yeah. These are games that matter less to me than the games that they've replaced. And when we're talking about college football, which is a sport that is more centered on the regular season than any other American sport, hands down.
Absolutely.
Like, this is it. We don't even really get 12 games. Honestly, we get like 9 if, you know, Vandy or Kentucky are having a down year. Maybe you're even only getting 8, 9, you know, games that are like really dramatic, like the outcome is not in doubt, games that matter. Like, that's it. 10 of them at the most, pretty much, and then maybe one bonus one after the season if you're lucky. And so to take one of those 10, to take one of those 9 in the wrong year and make it something that matters meaningfully less to me, is not something I have ever been a fan of. I said when they were expanding with Texas A&M and Missouri, I didn't like it. I thought they needed to go to 9 games then. I think they still need to go to 9 games now if they're not going to do it. I've been saying for years we ought to schedule Florida in the non-conference, as crazy as it sounds. Like, they need to do something to make the regular season matter as much as it can, and SEC expansion has worked to the detriment of that.
Yeah, I'm still not used to the whole playing Ole Miss every year thing. I mean, the only thing, the only thing that's made that palatable to me is that it's been kind of interesting, first with Tuberville and his connection, and then with Hugh Freeze and Gus with their connection. But other than those coaching and game style connections, it just doesn't feel like something that we should be doing every year. We hardly ever played Ole Miss before 1992. Hardly ever.
They could swap Ole Miss for Vanderbilt tomorrow, and it wouldn't make any difference to me. Fine, whatever, sure.
Right. I understand people that feel like LSU, just because the games have been so memorable, so many of them, that it is a big thing you'd kind of hate to lose. But let me just say one thing about Missouri, though. Actually, two things. I'm not going to say anything bad about Missouri being in the SEC for the obvious reason that it's close to me. Okay, I'm on the record as saying
it's a good reason.
I can drive like 9 hours to Auburn. I can drive like 5 hours to Kentucky or 4 hours to Vanderbilt, or I can go 2 hours over to Columbia and watch him play at Missouri, which I'm going to do this fall. Now, the problem with Missouri is they have not yet figured out that they're in the SEC and they should act like it, and here's what I mean. They made bunches of their tickets available. Now, this is a weird thing. I'm not sure what to think about it. And I hate to break some news here tonight, but let me get you guys' reaction to this. They said in their press releases and stuff that they anticipate Auburn being their biggest home game of the year. Okay, they've said that, that they think Auburn will be their biggest home game of the year. Now you think, oh, they must have sold this game out 6 months ago then, right, if it's their biggest home game of the year. They have made available to the St. Louis Auburn Club seats not in the Auburn section twice now. I know this because I have a bunch of them. And they're so nice about it, too. I called their athletic department. I spoke to a guy there. He was the nicest, friendliest. I mean, we had a long, fun conversation about SEC football and about Missouri and their campus and their stadium and this, that, and the other. Just the nicest guy everyone talked to. And I'm thinking, I can't think of any other SEC school that if I, as a visiting fan, called up and was wanting to buy tickets that they were offering outside of my own section, that they wouldn't be very brusque with me. How dare they be nice to me? Don't you know what conference this is, man? How dare you be friendly? You should be calling me names, for crying out loud. So I compliment Missouri. They're really classy people from my interactions with them. But that's not a good sign, is it?
John, you want to take that one?
No, they're not ready. But it's okay to be friendly. I mean, it's not, you know, and again, like, we can be polite to each other and respectful to each other. And, you know, you don't have to treat every interaction with an opposing fan doesn't have to be you treat them like dirt or whatever. So I appreciate it. I hope Auburn is respectful. Now, we're not ever going to give other teams fans like really good seats in our section or whatever. But I hope we're polite to them.
I got off the phone and I said,
what the hell is the world coming to?
But I mean, they were very nice. But I mean, yeah, they gave us sections of seats adjacent to the Auburn sections, but in their seats. And they don't, I mean, their stadium isn't small, but it's not humongous, you know. So what's going on over there?
That, to me, is far worse than the, like, politeness. I think the politeness and being nice is...
Well, I'm kidding.
That's just being nice. But if they're already making overtures to Auburn fans to try to get their tickets sold this far out...
Yeah.
Then that might be a bit of a problem. I would be surprised if they're calling Auburn the biggest home game of the year, though. They've got Florida and Tennessee coming in late in the season. South Carolina early on, the Battle of the Columbias there.
Mm-hmm.
So that sort of surprises me, that particular angle. I would guess maybe they're doing that because
we never play them.
Auburn won't be back to Columbia in 12 for 12 more
12,
years.
12 long years. Yes, exactly. I've been counting the minutes because I'm going to get to see like two more and I'll be dead. You know, I said something like, you know,
changes the schedule.
I said Auburn will come to Columbia for like the fourth time, but I can't be taken out of the nursing home for that, you know. So they've got to do something. That's just ridiculous. Because we were talking to Brandon about that last week. That is it really even a conference when you play somebody else every 12 years?
It's a scheduling arrangement.
Yeah, we play Clemson way more than that. They're not even in the... Well, they think they are, but they're not even in the SEC. My gosh, it drives me up. John, you're up.
All right, we're going to listener questions. We're skipping ahead.
Hold on.
It's time for listener questions.
Dun, 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 dun.
On the AU Wishbone Podcast.
Thank you, Mira. What we got, John?
All right, first question is from Dan in North Carolina, who says, what are y'all and Jerry's thoughts and expectations about Auburn men's basketball this year?
Ooh.
I keep hearing nice things this offseason.
Did y'all see the Austin Wiley clips is the question. That's probably
yes.
why we're talking about this.
Yes, I have not been so excited in the offseason in a long time for Auburn basketball.
I had to wipe some drool off my desk.
I didn't see it, but I keep seeing people talking about it, and I'm like, why didn't he do that for Auburn last season? What's happened?
Because he's put on like 25 pounds.
Okay. All right.
That's part of it. Also, he came like directly from high school.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he did his high school finals, and, you know, literally not more than like 10 days later, he was starting.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's not like he had a preseason to like get acclimated to like college basketball. He didn't even like get to play through the, you know, chumps at the beginning of the non-conference season and kind of work his way up. Like, he was in high school one day, and he's like trying to battle, you know, Yate Matin in the post like the very next week. It's not really the most conducive process towards maximizing your potential. But yeah, like not only, you know, are these clips of like, you know, Austin Wiley dunking ferociously on dudes, we have to remember these are not chumps by any stretch of the imagination. He's at a under 19 Team USA camp. These are the best like young basketball players in the entire country. John Calipari is there coaching them up. And he and Chuma Okeke are both there, both receiving rave reviews. So to answer Dan's question about expectations, with the roster Auburn has, like I remember, I think Auburn Undercover had a slideshow of like, it was just basically like, hey, let's look at Auburn's rotation for next year. And like you click through and it was like 10 players, 11 players, and every single one, I thought, you know what? That's an SEC caliber player. That's an SEC wow. caliber player.
Wow.
And, you know, not all of them are going to be like stars. You know, Davion Mitchell, the point guard that's coming in, you know, I think has a world of potential. It may take a year to reach it. But like every single one of those guys, I thought, okay, belongs in this league. And I cannot remember the last time I thought, you know, I've thought about that looking at Auburn's roster, you know, about the first five guys, the first six guys, you know, maybe the first seven, you know, at times.
First two or three.
Yeah, in some of the Barbie years.
Yes. Yeah.
Some of Lebo's poor moments. Oh, but, Lord. Yeah, like, I just remember flipping through that slideshow and just being so excited and thinking, like, this really, you know, this team absolutely has the most talent on it since Cliff Ellis was around. And in terms of depth, it may have more talent than even those squads. It's not going to have the same kind of results. I don't think they're going to go out and win the SEC the way they did in 99. But in terms of depth, like it's getting there. And I cannot wait. It's not a case of like, well, football's done. Shoot. I guess we're going to have to pay attention to basketball. Like that's not going to be the case. The very fact that we're talking about it right now, that like Auburn Twitter was seriously more invested in like these 5 second clips of Austin Wiley dunking than various like football developments, you know, in the early part of this week, is an indication of how excited people are. And in terms of expectations, I don't want to say NCAA tournament or bust because we didn't make the NIT last year. If they take a step forward, you know, make the NIT, that's still going to be positive progress. But I will be a little disappointed if they don't make the NCAAs. I think they've got that kind of talent.
You know, before you said that, I was just about to say, John, I think we can very tentatively warm up the NIT bandwagon. There you go. I'm excited. NIT, baby. We're coming.
I'm very excited, and Pearl's really good teams at Tennessee, they had a lot of depth, and they full court pressed a lot and ran up and down the floor a lot. And I think with the depth this team has, they're going to do a lot of that. So they'll be entertaining as well as
man
talented.
Depth. That's just not something I'm used to saying around Auburn basketball. All right,
next question.
Yes.
This is from Auburn Elvis.
Up. I love when John gets exasperated, and so do all the listeners.
A little less conversation, a little more action.
All right, go ahead.
All right, one thing I liked about – this is his question. One thing I liked about the 2013 schedule was how each opponent had a team strength that helped prepare us for a later, stronger opponent.
Yes, we talked about that.
Will that happen again this season, or does playing Clemson early screw that up?
Ooh. What do you think, Jerry? Where's our schedule?
That's a really interesting question. I would say, let me just say this about the Clemson game real quick. I'm glad we get that in the second week of the season. I don't like that we're playing Georgia Southern the first week because I don't think Georgia Southern helps us really get ready. But the sooner we can play those guys before their replacement quarterback really gets going, before their coaching staff, that has never, like, their current offensive play callers, whose names I can never remember. They've got the two co-OCs.
Jeff Scott and Tony something.
Yeah, you know, they haven't coached without Deshaun Watson yet. Chad Morris only left a couple of years ago. Deshaun Watson was already in place before Chad Morris left. It's going to be a lot harder adjusting to post-Chad Morris life when you also are dealing with post-Deshaun Watson life. I think the sooner we can play those guys, we're, you know, we also they're still hopefully enjoying their post-championship honeymoon. You know, later in the season, you wouldn't get that necessarily. Somebody else might knock them off first. I'm really happy to be playing those guys in week two. In terms of, you know, something earlier in the season helping for later, I mean, when you finish with Alabama, everything good that anybody brings to the table ahead of time is getting you ready for Alabama. And it's nice to feel like that'll matter again. I think it'll matter this season.
Well, and I think the Georgia trying to become Alabama light helps us prepare for Alabama because they're running a lot of the same defensive stuff that Alabama does. And Missouri has went to this kind of mad bomber passing kind of offense last year. And so maybe playing them before Ole Miss will help us. But
well, you know,
You can see Drew Locke as kind of a poor man's Shea Patterson. I think you can see that.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, the way it sets up, even if we lose to Clemson, which I hate to say, we could still – we have a very good shot at being 5-1 going to LSU. So, I mean, it lines up pretty nice. I don't know how well it, like, serves as a ladder almost like it did that year, but it certainly builds up. I mean, you know, if we should beat Clemson, then we've got a good – you know, we're going to go – we'll have the wind at our back going down to Tiger Stadium. That would be awesome. And then you know, we're going to do a whole show on that, obviously. But I feel like it doesn't necessarily build on itself like Elvis is talking about. But it's
not necessarily like a Mike Tyson punch-out deal where, like, Last Joe is at the beginning. You know, we're kind of getting bald bowl there in week two. It works nonetheless.
You know, the quarterback that reminds me of Deshaun Watson a little bit, and maybe I'm completely wrong here, but is the guy I'm looking forward to, and this is the kind of thing that John hates to talk about. Let me see what you think, Jerry. Justin Fields. John just checked out.
Is he your new crush over Joey Gatewood?
I've moved on. No offense, Joey, if you're listening.
No,
but
come on. We can't move. Joey Gatewood's the commit.
He's still
Justin Fields, I'm skeptical we're going to land Fields. I'll put it that way. The consensus seems to be he's a Florida lean, and we've already got a very, very sharp quarterback commitment. I am team Gatewood at this point. I think Justin Fields is a tremendous player. I think he deserves his 5-star rating. I think he's going to be a success wherever he goes. And I do think there is something to the Deshaun Watson comparisons. But I am hashtag team Gatewood at this point.
Do you not listen to the dudes on the other show, Jerry, that keep telling us that Joey Gatewood is destined to play tight end?
No.
He went to the Elite 11. What is it?
Yes,
he went as a quarterback
league. And supposedly didn't do very well.
It's the 11 best quarterbacks in the country with a bunch of people watching.
Well, I'm just telling you what the guy that runs the bowling alley and and breaks down film says. Not to pimp another show or anything, but they are on our network, right.
I'll just say this. I trust Gus Malzahn and Chip Lindsey when it comes to quarterback evaluation. Those guys have pulled in. Me with Gus's quarterback development, again, could be an entire other show. But if Gus says, we're going to take this guy who is a defensive back at Georgia and fumbled every other snap in JUCO, and we're going to have him throw for 450 yards at Brian Denny.
That's a good one.
I kind of... You know, I feel inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt.
Can't argue with that. All right, what else we got, John?
We have a really long kind of esoteric Reynolds Wolf question, but I'm considering, like, maybe we save that and y'all leap straight into soccer discussion.
Okay, we'll save Reynolds for I have his button ready to push here. If you want me to, okay. Well,
if you want to hear it, I'll read it.
All right, let's hold on.
I want the Reynolds. Reynolds has also been reading me for a long time. I would like
from the Weather Channel. Reynolds Wolf.
Thunder snow. All right.
All right. He says, a disclaimer, this is a topic I'd only ask during the long, boring, sweaty summer off season, not suitable for mid-October. He says, while driving on my way to work early one morning with the imaginary purple leprechaun who lives in my glove compartment and tells me to burn things, we listened to Brandon Marcello in a recent and different podcast, and there was a riveting, bubbling, and somewhat troubling discussion about the Auburn program. Who is the voice of and for Auburn football? And he says, I'm not referring to Rod Bramlett. Who is the titular head of the Auburn hierarchy?
I heard that conversation. That's a good question, yeah.
So he goes into more detail. Says that, you know, when it was Dye during his reign, he was in questionable power. Tuberville. They're often at war with shadowy members of the Board of Trustees, including one golem-like garden gnome of a creature banker whose name rhymes with Poppy Powder. Tuberville was still the man. And he says, and now with Gus, there seems to be silence. I don't like it. So who is the voice? Yeah. And now here's the second part of his question. Why do you think Gus is so secretive? And I mean secretive about himself. As a fan base, we've known him for 7 years as an offensive coordinator and head coach. Other than what we learned in his first few years, his history at Shiloh Christian, offensive coordinator at Arkansas Tulsa, head coach at Arkansas State, wife Christy, daughters, a nice BMW, likes Waffle House. Other than that, we know so little about him. He's very two-dimensional, and I'm not sure why. He says, I agree with Brandon Marcello. Gus has a story. I think many Auburn fans want to hear it. We want to like him. Many of us want to love him, and I'm sure we'll like and love him immensely with a successful season. But it's hard to love what you don't know, and we don't really know Gus. And he says, the purple leprechaun agrees, Weigel Reynolds.
He's got a career in writing when he's done with his Chasing Storms.
He does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
My response to that would be, first of all, I do love Gus that way. Like, and this is why, and it ties into the answer, too. Gus is a nerd.
Yeah.
Like, Gus is a big old geek. Mm-hmm. He happened to grow up in rural Arkansas, and he fell in love with football. But if he happened to have been born in California, he'd be like a Silicon Valley software billionaire by now.
That's
like, if he'd been, you know, born into like a military family, he'd be like a 4-star general overseeing like thousands of troops moving across a battlefield. He just happened to be born in Arkansas and fell in love with football. And so he's done the things that he's done within that capacity. But like me, you know, who I don't mind talking to my friends. I like hanging out with folks. But you get me in front of like a big crowd, like a party. I don't really like parties a whole lot. I'm a shy kind of dude. I'm a nerd. I'm a geek. Gus Malzahn, I think, is the same way. I think, you know, and these are kind of the whispers I've gotten, is that at some of these kind of, you know, booster bashes, everybody comes together and just he talks a little bit and there's, you know, it's just kind of hanging out, that he doesn't seem to necessarily be in his element in that kind of situation. And I think that plays a lot into it. I just think that Gus is the sort of nerdy guy that's just not necessarily comfortable putting himself all the way out there. I think occasionally some of the treatment he's gotten, you know, maybe has something to do with that. I think the Christy Malzahn horror edit tape, you know, that came out a couple of years ago, which I'm kind of personally still steamed about, you know, that kind of thing I don't think has helped matters. You know, I absolutely kind of sympathize with, you know, Brandon Marcello and trying to get him on the record and do this podcast. I don't think it's necessarily that Gus is like, you know, I think he's a nice guy. I think he's an affable guy. I'm still really thrilled that he is our football coach. I identify with him more than I have identified with any other Auburn football coach of my lifetime. You know, but, you know, I can still also say, well, it would be nice if he would go out and make a little bit more of an effort to, you know, be more approachable, to be more transparent. But I'm just not sure he's that kind of guy. And that doesn't bother me. I think he just is who he is. And again, I totally can identify with that to some extent. He just wants to be a guy who draws up X's and O's, who talks football, who hangs out with football players and football coaches, and that's his life. And he would prefer to kind of shove the rest of it. I think he's the opposite of a Mac Brown. Mac Brown didn't really want to deal with the football side of things. He was the schmoozer, the CEO. You know, that's why Mac Brown is great on television, and I do not think Gus Malzahn necessarily has a future in television. You know, he's totally on the end of the spectrum, and I think that's okay. I'm really glad that there's room in major college football and that there's room at Auburn University for a coach like this. So I'm still really thrilled that Gus is who he is and that he's Auburn's coach and that we're about to win at least 9 games, and I'm thinking 10. And, you know, so I get some of the frustration from, you know, Brandon and, you know, some other folks, you know, maybe from Reynolds as well. But I'm kind of on the other side of the fence. I think Gus is doing what works best for Gus, and it works for me too.
That's why I've stuck with him and fought as hard as I have for him all along too, is pretty much exactly. And I can't help but think,
I appreciate that, Jerry. That's special. That's special to hear you say that. I appreciate it. So,
but no, that I agree completely. Was that our last football, John?
That's the last American football question.
Oh, no, I have an American football question or two for Jerry, and I want to get it in before we run out of time, before John's wife and my wife come and drag us both out of our respective studios. All right, so about the U.S. men's national team,
Time out.
What? Yes.
For those of you wanting Auburn football discussion, that period has ended. We're moving into another phase of the podcast now, so you can, you know.
Now, I can come up with some Auburn football analogies, though, to try to answer Van's USMNT questions here. So there might be some sort of side content.
You realize that on Brandon's own show, he doesn't give, like, Batman warnings and say, we're going to now talk about Batman for 30 minutes, so you just tune out. So we don't have do that, John. We don't have to tell half the audience to leave just because we're changing to a different topic.
We've already
here.
Got their download or whatever, so all it's right. Okay. It's a service to them, the way I view it. I used to listen to this. Fantasy football or fantasy baseball podcast at ESPN, and they literally had a sound drop, and it was like doop doop doop, nothing but nonsense from this point forward. So,
what we're dealing with here is a complete lack of respect for the law.
All right, so here is where I'm going with this, Jerry.
Hit me.
We were on the verge of not making qualification for the World Cup. Now, the U.S. is, I don't know what the record is, but, you know, after 50 years of not qualifying, this will be our 8th in a row if I'm doing my math right. And that's pretty impressive. I mean, England hadn't gone to the last 8 in a row. France hadn't gone to the last 8 in a row. You got to look at the blue bloods, you know, like Italy, Brazil, Argentina. They're the only ones that have gone like the last 8 in a row. So that's pretty amazing, but we were about to miss out under Jurgen Klinsmann. We ditched Klinsmann. Bring back out of the crypt Bruce Arena, who's aged 50 years in the last 10 years or whatever. And lo and behold, we beat the snot out of Trinidad, take Tobago away from them. And then we go and get 3 points there, which was big, right? Stop the bleeding.
Yes.
Then we go down to the Azteca, where we never have won a significant game. And not only do we go into the Azteca to play Mexico, and we've never won there ever in a significant game, we also, at the last minute, Arena changes our entire strategy, our entire lineup, of 7 players different, including the goalkeeper. What did you think about that, and how did you kind of evaluate what came out of that, which was a 1-1 victory for the United States of America?
That was definitely one of those draws that felt like a win, no question about that. Mm-hmm. What I took out of it is that Arena knows what the hell he's doing. Like, you look at his post-game comments and the post-game comments of the players, and they said, like, as soon as they got together to start training for both of those games, Trinidad and Tobago, I think, was on, a Thursday night, and then Mexico was on Sunday.
Yeah.
They said, you know, from day one of getting that roster together, that Arena sat him down and said, look, this is what we're going to play when we go to Mexico. Like, we're going to play. You know, usually they go 4-4-2, four defenders, four midfielders, two strikers. This time, basically, they were playing a 5-4-1. They're basically playing with five defenders, four midfielders, and one forward, which sounds really defensive. And in some ways it is,
But then they didn't play defensive though. They played what looked like a park the bus in front of the goal strategy lineup, and then they countered.
They did. Like, that's the mark of a well-coached team, is that you can put them out in a formation and they don't just rigidly stick to it. Like, yeah, the two guys on the outside of that five, DeAndre Yedlin on the right, DeMarcus Beasley, who I think is at least 412, he may be a Highlander, I'm not sure, on the left.
Yes.
Like, those guys got forward whenever the U.S. got the ball. They didn't worry about playing defense. They got forward. The U.S. got their goal, a fluke in terms of, like, Bradley couldn't do that again.
No.
If he tried to do it 30 times.
It's amazing.
But, you know, they got their goal. I think it was deserved, and they got a deserved point out of it. It's like Klinsmann, you know, and I think every single U.S. like soccer writer after the game basically wrote the same column, which was that Jurgen Klinsmann monkeyed with the formation right before they played Mexico in Columbus at the start of this round of qualifying, and the players found out about it like only a couple of, like, I think the night before the game, basically. So they didn't even have a full practice where they knew that was the formation that they were going to use. They hadn't really devoted a lot of time to it in training, and the players had to talk Klinsmann like out of that formation halfway through the first half because it had been such an just complete disaster on the field. They'd already given up one goal. They could have given up more. So you contrast that kind of preparation with the way Arena approached things, and it really is just night and day. And that's why, barring just total catastrophe, yes, the U.S. will be going to another World Cup.
And that's amazing. I mean, Bruce Arena, what went wrong with Klinsmann beyond just like tiny little tactics like that? I mean, was he just never a good fit, or was he trying to do things that didn't, that just weren't working for what we have, or what? What do you think?
It's very difficult for any coach at the international soccer level to coach for more than one World Cup cycle.
Yeah.
You come in, you get them through qualifying, you get them through the World Cup, and typically that's it.
Yeah.
It's really rare for national team coaches to stay any more than 3 or 4 years at a time. And so it was a little, you know, they really should have just parted ways after the World Cup. And Klinsmann, frankly, did a fine, if not spectacular, job.
Yeah.
You know, in the previous cycle, like, they won the hexagonal, like this last round of World Cup qualifying, they won that pretty easily, even as Mexico was tripping all over themselves and needed the U.S. to save them to even get to the World Cup. You know, the U.S., for anyone listening but not necessarily following, the U.S. beat Panama in a critical game where Panama could have eliminated Mexico if they'd gotten a result in that game. The U.S. beat them even though they were already qualified to help Mexico along the way inadvertently.
That was what happened four years ago. Did Klinsmann's team almost won the dang Confederations Cup? Wasn't that Klinsmann's team, or was that Bradley?
No, they didn't advance to the Confederations Cup. They won the Gold Cup back in 2013 have a chance to play the Confederations Cup. Anyways, they went to the World Cup, got out of an extremely difficult group, and not by accident. Like, they played really well against Portugal. They got a little bit fortunate against Ghana, but played a pretty solid game in that game as well. And so, you know, that was a major accomplishment as well. If Klinsmann leaves the U.S. at the end of that World Cup, you know, he rides off and it's a total success.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is just, I think he did have, his message was very kind of gung-ho, let's work hard, let's, you know, practice all the time, and very sort of like rah-rah, as opposed to a more intellectual, tactical sort of thing. And I think that wore on the players, and I think once you have a downturn in results after all of this rah-rah, let's go stuff, it just doesn't work anymore. And so I think he'd lost the respect of his players. I think he'd lost the locker room. And then you pile on his lack of tactical know-how, which I think he'd been able to kind of paper over to some extent with, you know, some of his previous emphases on fitness, on, you know, motivation, this kind of thing. And recruiting. The guy's a phenomenal recruiter, no doubt about that. You know, there's a lot of dual nationals that are playing for the United States that could play for other countries that are playing for us because of Jurgen Klinsmann. You know, he's a little bit of the, I don't know, the Brady Hoke of international soccer, leaving the cupboard quite full for the next guy. But it was time, like, absolutely no question. The players had tuned him out. It was time for him to go.
Yeah, Bruce Arena did two cycles, and his second one didn't go as well as the first either, if I recall correctly. So yeah,
no, they made the World Cup, but then they kind of did not do well at the World Cup. That was 2006, and they went out in the first round, which is the last time they failed to get out of the first round. Actually.
Right, yeah. So what do you think are – this is the last thing then, and we'll probably wrap up. What do you think our chances are going into – assuming that we can go ahead and finish out and qualify – and, of course, we don't know what the draw is yet. We don't know who will be in. We don't know hardly anything. But, I mean, with the players we have now, with Bruce Arena back, seeming like he's even better coach in some ways than he was before, you know, how far do you think we can get, realistically, this team?
I mean, depending on the draw, I don't think the quarters or the semis are insane. Internationals, like the World Cup has gotten, as scoring has gone down to some extent, it's gotten much more random. Yeah. Like Costa Rica made the quarterfinals last time.
Costa Rica
can make the quarterfinals. I'm pretty sure the United States can reach the quarterfinals. Yeah. So that would not necessarily surprise me. I think Arena is very good at the kind of like pack and counter game that the U.S. could use to spring an upset there at that World Cup. Came very close to doing it against Germany back in all the way in 2002. That was kind of the same style that they played to beat Mexico in that tournament, which was when they made the quarterfinals, which is their best World Cup performance. So I think that quarters is certainly attainable with the right draw, maybe even the semis. I have a hard time seeing them go any further than that. But, you know, Bradley is going to be absolutely in his prime. Christian Pulisic is going to have a pretty decent amount of experience under his belt by that point. They've got a lot of other young guys I'm really excited about. Kellen Acosta, one of the new faces that was in that lineup for the Azteca last Sunday, is going to be a phenomenal player. He's the perfect partner for Bradley. I cannot wait to see the two of them play more together. The back line has a higher ceiling than it's had in years. I absolutely think, now, you know, we could get a World Cup draw with, like, you know, Germany, Argentina, and, you know, then they play three games and go out. But the potential is there, I absolutely think, to repeat the 2002 quarterfinals performance and maybe even go further than that.
Yeah, well, makes me feel good. I still feel like we're a couple of really world-class players away in a couple of positions from quite being a power, but you know, like you say, if everything lines up right, as long as we don't draw into a group with like Brazil and like the Netherlands and, you know, whoever else to round it out, then. John, you got any last questions or thoughts for Jerry before we wrap up tonight?
No, I really appreciate you doing this, taking the time to do this. This was fun, and, you know, we look forward to, you know, talking to you again during the season at some point.
I was going to say, I mean, you know, twist my arm to have to sit down and talk Auburn football and U.S. men's soccer for a while. Guys, it's been a huge sacrifice to come through this. But I guess if you beg me enough, I might be willing to sit down and talk Auburn football. Excellent. And U.S. soccer again at some point in the future. Seriously, it's been great. And, you know, it's been what I expected it to be, which is hanging out and, you know, talking about stuff I love to talk about. So it's been a pleasure.
Very good. All right. Well, another great guest in the books, John, another great Auburn guy that we love and respect and are glad to have on. We have to thank our patrons who help keep our shows on the air and keep White Rocket flying along. That begins with Nicholas Cottrell. And, of course, also David Medinas, Mark Squire, Dave Powell, Jared Albrick, Rich Reimer, Michael Kirshner, Bill Matthews, Joey Miller, Matthew Wagstaff, and our newest patron, Phil Amthor of WeHaveDonuts.com. So be sure to visit WeHaveDonuts.com. It's a Birmingham-based business that makes the most incredible original donuts. And WeHaveDonuts.com is our, that's WeHave, DOUGHNUTS.com. And you can go to www.patreon.com, Patreon, Patreon.com/Van Allen Plexico. I really need to come up with a shorter address to get to that, don't I? I guess in the future I'll put it on Plexico.net, but for now it is... it is a link to from our Podbean page. So if you go to auwishbone.podbean.com. There will be a link to the Patreon page on every show posting. And there you can, for as little as $1 a month, sign up to help support the show. You can do more, but and we certainly welcome it. And we're up to, I think, 11 patrons now. We're doing better, but we're still not even halfway to our monthly goal. So please visit www.patreon.com/VanAllenPlexico. And you can support White Rocket's efforts to bring you the best in Auburn podcasts, books, and a whole bunch of other stuff that you might enjoy as well. So I guess that'll do it. Our time is up. We thank you for yours. War Eagle, guys.
War Eagle, man.
Thanks for listening to the Wishbone Podcast. All past episodes are available at auwishbone.podbean.com and via iTunes. For more Auburn fun, join us on Facebook at facebook.com/auwishbone and follow the show on Twitter at auwishbone. War Eagle.
So what becomes of
This has been a White Rocket Entertainment production.
Thank you for listening to the AU Wishbone Podcast.
Go to bed.